remember a time of chaos, ruined dreams, this wasted land. But most of all, I remember the road warrior, the man we called Max. To understand who he was, you have to go back to another time.
Welcome to the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast, Mad Max Retrospective Series.
Not this again! I've been assigned!
Join Garrett.
Perfect in every way.
Matt.
You. It's your lucky day.
And the returning Mick Duffy.
Remember me.
As they review the franchise that revolutionized low-budget filmmaking.
Hey, listen, man. Will you listen to me?
From the gritty 1979 Mel Gibson starring original.
I've seen the style before. Terminal Psychotic.
To the 2015 mega hit, Mad Max Fury Road.
Max. My name is Max.
All the way to George Miller's prequel, Furiosa.
This one has all their teeth.
The boys will review each film in the series, one car chase at a time, to see why and how this franchise just keeps on going.
Together, they can be very powerful.
So strap yourself in, percolated media listeners.
What are you doing? Praying. To who? Anyone that's listening.
The Three Men and a Retrospective Mad Max series begins now.
Now we bring home the booty!
Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, released July 10th, 1985. Budget on this was $10 million. Box office, $36 million. And this is directed by George Miller and George Ogilvy. Mick, I want to go to you right off the bat. I noticed two directors this time. It's not just George Miller.
Yeah.
What happened there?
Well, this film's kind of, its genesis is a little odd, because obviously after the success of the second movie, George Miller and his producer Byron Kennedy were keen to produce a sequel, and Warner Brothers were also extremely keen for there to be a follow-up, and Byron Kennedy sadly died. So Byron Kennedy, who'd been, you know, such a tireless producer for Miller, who had gotten the first and second films off the ground, and again, these were massively successful, and, well, part of these films being massively successful is that George Miller and Byron Kennedy, even just right after the first one, were suddenly fantastically wealthy. And unfortunately, it was a kind of wealthy where you can suddenly buy a helicopter. So Byron Kennedy had actually learned to fly a helicopter, and he'd been scouting locations for a third Mad Max film when he came down to a little over a lake. And any part of a helicopter touches any part of the water and you're done for. So he died in 1983 in that accident, and that left kind of George Miller in charge of the whole company. For, I think, for the first two films, Kennedy has been his collaborator, but also his sort of administrative, you know, head and his right brain, really, yes. Mm. And Miller now suddenly has more things to do. You know, he was apparently initially even reluctant to do this, and apparently he considered just quitting filmmaking because he couldn't imagine continuing without his partner. So that's part of the reason he brought George Ogilvy on, and Ogilvy had directed some TV stuff for Kennedy Miller. After the second film, before the third film in the series, they had produced a number of like miniseries for Australian television. So they, you know, they'd established themselves as a company that did things other than the Mad Max films, and Ogilvy had come from that world. And I think he also had a theatre background. And so Miller having more things to do in terms of production is part of the reason why he hired a co-director, but also this film's full of children. And, I mean, we can get to this, but have you ever worked in a film production capacity with children?
Yeah, I haven't myself, no. I've had children in films I've been involved in, but never to this capacity, never to the point where there was like a whole society of them.
No, because even when just like, as you know, if you're shooting anywhere vaguely civilized, there are union laws. And yeah. I've done this. I shot I had to shoot a short film for a client a couple of years ago, and it had a child cast. And even the child chaperone, and you know, the child supervisor instead is somebody I've known for many, many years. It was still kind of, her whole thing was like, Mick, I love you and everything, but if you go a minute over the time you're allowed legally to have children on set, I'm walking and shutting this down. And she was right to say that, because that is the right answer, yeah? And I wouldn't want anyone who didn't treat that responsibility seriously, but, you know, with children on set, you've less time during the day to work with. Mm-hmm. So bringing in another director is a smart move.
Yeah, they tell you don't work with children, don't work with dogs. Now, I have worked with dogs, and those, oh my God, those can be a pain in the ass if they're not trained right. You know, when you're working with independent film, most of the time they're not trained right. So you just go, okay, I have a big white dog that fits this. Okay, we'll just put that one in, and it doesn't behave at all. But I just could not imagine working with a bunch of children. I mean, good Lord. So where's the demarcation line then? From what I understand it, George Miller really emotionally, as you mentioned, just kind of wasn't too into finishing this film. So he brought this George Ogilvy in to finish it for him. There have been stories out there that maybe he was there to work on the dramatic scenes and Miller was there for the action scenes, or that Ogilvy was there for the children's scenes and Miller was there for the dramatic scenes. Like, where exactly is the demarcation there? Do you know?
I remember there was an interview with both of them in Starlog magazine in summer of 85 when this came out. And, man, if I still have that copy of Starlog, it's somewhere in my mum's attic. So I don't have it to hand. But I remember in it Ogilvy saying that he directed one stunt.
Really?
That he directed. But one of the stunts he directed, that wasn't his, you know, métier, but he got a little bit of experience of shooting one stunt and a little bit of action stuff on it. But most of that's George Miller. And that they were sort of splitting up the directing stuff, but that Ogilvy was very good with children. I can imagine this sort of being I don't even think this would be this person's shooting with a unit separately whilst I'm doing something else situation. It might be more of Ogilvy is talking to the child cast whilst Miller is talking to the DP, you know, about how we're lighting this and what are our camera moves. I mean, I can imagine some kind of split like that happening, but it is strange for like a film series to suddenly go dual directors in its third installment. I can't think of anything else where something comparable has happened.
Bad Boys 3.
Oh, really? Oh, right, yes, it's got two.
Yes. Oh, yeah, because that has a pair. I think he's just talking about plan like this, you know, where somebody was brought in because of a tragedy, that kind of thing.
Does Justice League count?
Oh, Lord. No, we're not allowed to speak of it.
We're not allowed to speak of that film after we reviewed it a couple years ago. No, it wouldn't, just because that was somebody who was brought in. Yes, it was the result of a tragedy, but that was somebody who was brought in to finish something that was started by somebody who had left that set. This was started by somebody who was still on the set by the time it was over. So I think Mick's right. I can't think of anything where something was actually done like this.
I can think of one example. If you know the English director Michael Powell?
Yeah.
You know, Scorsese is hugely influenced by and George Miller, mm-hmm. but normally Michael Powell were the films of Powell and Pressburger, because started off as a solo director, then he's got this whole middle phase of his career where he's producing, writing, and directing with Emmerich Pressburger. So they're a unit. So I think it's a little like that.
I was thinking hard. I actually have an example. I would count Singing in the Rain, because you had Donnan doing all the visual stuff with the musical parts, and Gene Kelly basically directed the music and the choreography.
Oh, God, yes.
Well, no matter how they got it done, this movie was released in 1985. Full-on hit. It more than tripled its budget. And you know what? I remember, Mick. I remember the days MTV was in full tilt. This video with Tina Turner playing this title song was on every single day. I worked at a casino where this song was on every single day, probably twice a goddamn day. And they got really good reviews from Siskel and Ebert. I think Ebert even made it one of his top 10 films of the year. Yeah. And another point I want to make, too, Lethal Weapon was the movie that really made Mel Gibson a huge movie star. But 1985 was the year he became a star, because he was on the cover of People magazine as its sexiest man alive, which was the first year they had done that. They ended up doing it for like 30-some years. I don't know if they still do it. I'm not a big People magazine reader.
They still do
What's
it.
That? Oh, do they? Okay. Well, yeah, he was their first sexiest man of the year. So he was on his way. I mean, he had done like Tequila Sunrise and all these other films where he was really trying to get respect as an actor, not trying to do these little action films. Little did he know he would become a huge action star just a few short years later. Mick, have you ever seen Tequila Sunrise?
I've not seen all of it. It's got this one astonishingly short sequence. Yeah, there's one, like, I'm sure if you go Google, if you go on YouTube and go Tequila Sunrise film, there's this one scene that's shot entirely in silhouette against the sun setting, with two of the characters having a conversation on, like, a swing as the sun's setting, and it's just it's the most astonishing sort of a visual. And I remember nothing else about the movie other than that one scene, which is just gorgeous to behold. Yeah, no, it's weird, because, right, 1985, this year, Mel Gibson becomes a star, and we kind of know this because this is the first time one of these films has mentioned Mel Gibson by name in the trailer.
For sure, and this was a movie that, now I mentioned last week, this was a movie I hadn't seen all the way through until 2015, getting ready for Fury Road, but I had seen so many bits and pieces of, because this was on HBO or Showtime all the time when I was growing up. I think I had seen it all, but I had seen it in all in pieces because my dad would watch it every time it was on. And it was one of those things where I was always watched the same scene every single time. Like I would turn it on or my dad would turn it on and it would be at the same scene. Mick, did you see this in theaters?
No. By the time this opened, my hometown no longer had a cinema.
What?
Yeah, no, my hometown from like 1981 through to, I want to say 1995, 96, didn't have a cinema. A, this was a bad time for cinemas generally during in Britain and Ireland. At that time, they were definitely having a big downturn. But also, I grew up in the north of Ireland. Cinemas weren't the kind of business people wanted to run in a small town because you weren't guaranteed that people would turn up. Or I don't oversell it, but, there's always a risk that your thing will get bombed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a bunch of things, we didn't have a cinema for the same reason we didn't have a decent restaurant. So yeah, any business that's dependent upon footfall at night wasn't really a good idea in my time during those years. So apart from pubs always did great. So many pubs. But what I do remember is when this was having its massive rollout and they clearly sent the same press kit to every newspaper, but my town's newspaper ran the full press kit for this I don't even remember this, when a movie came out. They would send a little package to your local newspapers and there'd be like a quiz or some kind of prize giveaway or little things like that, yes. And I remember my local town paper had this thing that, God, I can still recall the sort of potato print quality of the illustration. They had two puzzles to promote this. One was like a word search where you could look for Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome related words in a word search. And the other one was a maze, with little kids' maze games, yes. Uh-huh. And I still remember it because it's got this bad drawing of Mel Gibson. And it was basically like, "Hi kids, I'm Mad Max. Can you help me take my camel train to Bartertown?" I remember just as a child just cringing at this and going like, really? And also, my town doesn't have a cinema. No one's going to see this movie for another 12 months, when it turns up on video.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so you saw this on video initially.
I saw this on video initially, yes.
Okay. After its initial theatrical run, you didn't see it, years later. You saw it pretty much that same year.
Yeah, I saw it on, in 1986 when it was available on home video. So, yeah.
Now, Matt, where are you coming from on this? Did you watch this in a row with Road Warrior? Both of you gentlemen gave Road Warrior a 10 out of 10 last week. You guys obviously hold that film in regard. Matt, did you watch this right after that viewing?
Not immediate afterwards, because being the age I am, it's one of those instances where you hear from fans, this is the one that's not talked about as much as the first two. And when I did some digging into the reason why and hearing that it was quote-unquote kiddified, by contrast, look, Garrett, you know me. I'm kind of notorious for bad-mouthing franchises when they go that route. So I kind of had that reluctance going in. And I always told myself, how do you go from the Road Warrior and Mad Max to a movie where he saves a bunch of kids that are inspired by the Lost Boys from Peter Pan? I just never saw that correlation.
I have a feeling George Miller didn't see that correlation either, but we'll get into it.
But yeah, I went into it knowing that it had sort of not an overly bad reputation, because this is not one of those movies where it's hated or is that much of a black sheep. It's just by comparison to the first two, sort of like Return of the Jedi. I think that's the comparable example I would use, where the first two movies in the original Star Wars trilogy, like Mad Max, are the ones that are talked about the most, and the detractors for Beyond Thunderdome and Return of the Jedi use that thing of the Ewoks and the kids being sort of the thing where we have to tie this into a younger demographic. Let's also remember, Hollywood is notorious and this kind of started around this time, of marketing stuff, franchises that started out as adults, were clearly for adults, but had kid-centric elements like RoboCop, Rambo, would both do this not too long afterwards.
Yeah, but what's weird about this one is you have a fuck in here, you have a lot of car violence and things, like there's still stuff in here that makes it feel like an R-rated franchise, but it is PG-13.
Yeah, but even the one F-word, I mean, it's happening over a point of view shot, yes?
You're right, yeah.
So it's, every time we'd see this film on TV, that F-word was very easily removed, and I think once you take that out, this is basically a PG.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, let's see how much of a PG film we have here. We start off 15 years after the end of Road Warrior with an overhead shot of some familiar Dune-type atmosphere. Great overhead shot, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, which is weird, Mick, because you mentioning that Kennedy had died in a helicopter crash, they're going full out here.
Yeah, it's also doing the thing that, because this opening shot is great, the fact that it starts from so far away and then gets close to the dune buggy being pulled by a team of camels that mm-hmm. Max is on. But as soon as we cut from that shot, we realize the shot was a point of view shot. And it's the thing that I don't know if you know the late Japanese animation director Satoshi Kon, but that was one of his favorite tricks, to start a scene or a sequence with a shot that you think is an establishing shot, but then it turns out to be a character's POV. I always wonder if he saw this and a light bulb went off. This film is gorgeously photographed. That's something very clear watching this on the Blu-ray, because I don't think I'd seen this in full since the VHS era.
Wow, it tells you how many times you revisited this.
Yeah, yeah.
You haven't seen it that many times. We see a very happy monkey, and then a body that is indeed Max. And let's talk about Mel in this film a little bit. This is the last time that we will see Mel play this role. He spends the first 45 minutes or so in this horrendous 80s hair metal wig, and then he'll lose it. But I will say, I think this is the best Mel has been all series. I think Miller is trying to give him more to do in this. We'll talk about it. I see him being more of a contemporary character here, even if the character himself still isn't very likable.
So this is a strange instance when I look at franchises that have a central character. In the instance that I get Gibson is better from an acting quality, and I'm impressed that for a movie that does have some, let's call it tonal inconsistencies that we'll divulge into, he still feels like the same character, slightly more evolved. And I think that's because George Miller, his approach to all of these movies is, from two on, Max is a mythic figure. And because of that, I look at these all as stories being told over a campfire. And because of that, you have the ability to portray him in different ways. You can make him a little more stoic. You can make him a little bit more silent. You could make him more smartassy based on if you look at it from that perspective. And I think that's why I appreciate what Gibson does here and what Miller does, because he still feels like the same guy. And I would compare this to, this is certainly a better movie, but you know, Escape from LA, it's a terrible movie,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't ruin the character of Snake Plissken. He still feels like the same guy, even though the movie is considerably goofier than he is. I would compare it, Beyond Thunderdome, the better version of that. I think it's a much better movie than Escape from LA, but it has that same thing of, even though Max is different, I still buy him as the same character.
Yeah, I think he's much improved. I think one of the things here with this series is that the world is always much more interesting than Max is. Certainly in the first film, I don't think pre-trauma Max is a terribly interesting character. And in the second film, well, okay, Max works as a character, but he's very much this archetype. In this one, I think he's definitely getting more stuff to do, and I like the fact that Max gets to be a little bit sardonic in some of his verbal exchanges without it tipping over into full kind of Chris Pratt contemporary movie hero smartassdom, which is distancing. You know, it still feels perfectly okay that Max is not even joking, but he's occasionally saying things that are true and read as funny, but they're not really smart-ass quips, right?
Yeah, that's always been my beef with this series. You guys have given hugely positive reviews to the previous movies. My big issue with those movies are the title character is the least interesting thing about this series. And what I'm seeing Gibson try to do here is make him more interesting. Here.
I think his lack of interest, and it's why I'm not as strong on the first one compared to the Road Warrior, is that the first one, they try to make him a character with an arc where he loses his humanity and all that stuff. But the world is so much more interesting than he is. And that's why I like 2 and 3 better, is that he's just a vessel to experience this world through. in the same way, you might as well call him the Road Warrior from 2 and 3. The Max name almost could be something he picked up from a sign that you see in certain like apocalyptic movies where people just take on new personas. You kind of look at it that way. But the fact that Max is not as much of a character in 2 and 3 is one of the reasons why I like these better than the first one. And I don't put that as a knock on the series the way you do.
We see a huge mining colony, a place we will come to know as Bartertown. And I have to say right off the bat, boys, you know, my favorite parts of this movie take place here in Bartertown. I love the look of this place. And unlike the last set of production designs, which weren't bad, don't get me wrong, but they were kind of boring to look at. Here, there's always something to look at. And honestly, I wish we'd have spent more time here.
I love the design work in this movie.
Yeah.
I know there are a couple of instances where it goes a bit too far and it's about, oh, this is a mid-80s sci-fi movie for sure. But no, I really like the level of detail in it. I like the fact that it sort of feels convincingly lived in. I like the fact that all of the extras have sort of very idiosyncratic looks to them. It feels detailed in the way that European sci-fi comics from the 70s and 80s feel. I don't know if you've ever seen any of those sort of Mobius' stuff. It feels a bit Mobius-y. It feels a bit 2008-y. It has that nice quality to it. It also feels very spaghetti Western.
Definitely. I got a lot of Western here.
Yeah, so I know I love the look. The design works great. I like it a lot. Even just watching the sort of the extras milling around the entrance to Bartertown. You know, the draw with Blade Runner is, I think, for a lot of people, just how detailed that world looks. I feel the same about Bartertown. I'd love to hang out in Bartertown for an afternoon.
Definitely be interesting. Matt, how do you feel about Bartertown?
I don't know if I get a hotel here, but I'd gladly do the just visiting type of vacationing. I like how it's also an evolution of this series where we've seen the fall of civilization, basically, in the first one. Law and order is there, but it's becoming more and more fragmented until it evaporates entirely by the time you get to the Road Warrior. There's a small group that he saves in the second one, but it's not really much of structure. It's almost like a big campground. This one, I like how civilization is starting to regroup in the way that you had all the different civilizations that came out of the Dark Ages. That's kind of the equivalency I use with Bartertown, and I think it's the strongest part of the movie. This is one of those things where I think the world is great, and I wish it was 100% of the movie.
So as he heads into the cave, Max says that he's looking for someone who is driving a team of camels. But this guy he's talking to just isn't budging. Max fires his shotgun, and the trader says if Max trades 24 hours of his life, he will get back what was stolen from him.
Yeah.
So he's going to have Max work here and pretty much earn his keep.
Yeah. Minutes into this, we're already stumbling into one of my favorite things about this series, which is the opportunity for venerable Australian character actors to play complete weirdos dressed strangely. So the guy who's the character named the Collector, the guy who's sort of the doorman at Bartertown, an amazing Australian character actor called Frank Thring, whom, have you seen Howling 3, The Marsupials?
Not willingly, no.
No one has, and it's not great, but he basically plays Alfred Hitchcock in that. Fantastic and interesting character actor, and the sort of person I guess we wouldn't normally see in a big film like this. I love that aspect of these movies, that if you've got a weird Australian character actor who hasn't been in one of these yet, or maybe even if they already have, they'll find a role for him.
That seems to be Miller's MO, right? Yeah, he always finds roles. I mean, we'll talk about it in the next couple of weeks, too. He always finds roles for these people.
There's also the other thing we have to talk about, and I thought this was the road Mick was about to take. In the opening, the person in the helicopter that basically carjacks his property is Bruce Spence from the previous movie, even though he's an entirely different character. Which I like.
Yes,
this also enhances my perspective on treating this as campfire stories, where it gives you credence to use the same actors in different roles. George Miller does not care about continuity as much as he cares about the world, and I think that is something that a lot of people may look at as a negative, but I view it as a positive because I treat these all as episodic stories that you could find in like a compilation that someone would write, like a Paul Bunyan or Johnny Appleseed, to use some American counterparts. And, you know, we'll see this continue with Fury Road and Furiosa. So that's something he's always done with this franchise. And it's something that I like a lot. It lets people play different roles while sometimes doing something different. But oftentimes there's a spiritual connection, not necessarily a literal one.
Well, we'll talk about it in a couple of weeks, but Furioso seems like the only time he does care about continuity.
To an extent.
We'll get there. Yeah.
We'll get there. One thing I noticed in this movie, guys, is, you know, the previous two films were pretty straightforward. No real satire in those films. Here, I am feeling satire, especially the scene of Mel just letting loose of his weapons as he just doesn't seem to run out of them. This is all fun stuff, and I don't know if this is Ogilvy's influence or this is Miller kind of lightening the tone, but a little bit of a lighter tone here.
Oh, considerably. Not to a degree that I'm going to say. This is kind of the Hollywoodization of a film franchise becomes, where you have something that started really underground, oftentimes foreign. You get a mainstream studio, they put a big name in it. So because of that, we got to be a little bit more, I don't want to say lighter, but everything's a lot flashier. You know, there's a big star in this. This kind of starts that road that continued for decades of taking a pre-established property and kind of putting the glitz and glamour of big studio filmmaking on it. This is kind of where it starts in my mind.
Yeah, but I think even at this, because this is, I mean, Dean Semler's work on the previous film is good, but this is beautifully photographed here. This is a production where clearly they had the budget for all the best lenses and the time to do complicated setups and play with lighting more, and it is gorgeous. But I do like the fact that there are kind of weird snippets of a continuity between this and the previous films, like when Max is speaking to the collector to get let in. I mean, yeah, in one hand he's got a shotgun, but in the other hand he's got a handgun, he's got a Mauser, and it looks like it's Bubba Zanetti's gun from the first film. The gun he gets shot with. So wow. My headcanon is that at some point he went back and ransacked all those corpses for gear. So I like that. I like that little detail.
So Max has walked back outside where we see Bruce Spence again, and he takes this elevator that honestly I don't think it would even hold Goudreau's weight, let alone these four people. They head into a tent-like atmosphere. Again, very cool, as we have a sax player here for some ungodly reason. I don't know why.
Oh, because it's awesome. And it's also because Tina Turner's character Anti-Entity, and we'll get to that, but like the kings and queens and lords of old, she can afford to have a musician on just retainer, right?
Yeah, like, we see this a lot in the 80s. We'll see this in Lost Boys. For some reason, there's a saxophone player just out of nowhere. It's a lot of sax.
Lisa Simpson would use this for years to come. It is the
yes.
It is the instrument, certainly the brass instrument of mainstream entertainment. But I also look at it as, in a lot of ways, like musicians are kind of a comparable medieval equivalent to court jesters, where they're there strictly for entertainment. Yeah. That's how I'm viewing this lens. It's a little bit meta, given who plays Auntie, so I like that touch.
And the saxophone player is blind.
Blind, huh?
Yeah, you see his eyes. He's got his corneas are frosted over. There's no way he has functional eyesight. So it's I would say the assumption, I guess, is that this is somebody who would not be able to survive by himself in the wasteland, but he's a skill that's useful to somebody who has lots of resources and food. And music is a thing you would miss, right? So having young sax oftenist is a good thing. Yeah.
We then get the entrance of Auntie herself, Tina Turner. Now let's talk about Tina Turner here. I remember her playing a bigger role in this movie, and for some reason I remembered her fighting Max. I remember her getting into the Thunderdome, and I thought maybe her and Max had a final showdown. That doesn't happen. She's a very big presence. I don't know what she's doing with that accent. I like her here. I just wish there was more of her.
I think she's great, and it's again the Hollywoodization. If you look at big movies in the 80s, think about how many of them had direct involvement of big, boisterous, flamboyant musicians having roles. Purple Rain, Prince, Labyrinth, David Bowie, Grace Jones in a James Bond movie. This. So it's copying that trend while also doing something different. And I think she has phenomenal screen presence and actually fits the world, being her accent is unidentifiable. I like how it's kind of like an assimilation of different cultures that make up Bartertown. She's probably the, if I had to point to like the best thing in the movie, aside from the production design and one scene coming up, she'd probably be my strongest asset. And I think if you had cast a traditional actress who was big around that time, I think it would have been entirely different. She fits the theatricality that Bartertown presents. I mean, she is an entertainer in her own life, and Thunderdome itself is all about the glitz and the glamour. She's kind of like Vince McMahon.
Yeah,
God, well, I mean, there'll be a lot of wrestling references in this podcast. I'm warning people right now.
Yeah, when I watch this film, the thing that I always think is, because Tina Turner is great in this. Tina Turner is a, you know, she's a very big presence in this, but hell, she slots right into this universe.
Yeah.
That's, yeah, it just, without any issue whatsoever. And there's two things going on. I think her performance is perfectly modulated for this story and this material. And also, because she's Tina Turner, and I know this is part of the reason why they cast her, but she's bringing some of that Tina Turner real life backstory with her, where Tina Turner's career kind of ended and then she had one of the most extraordinary second acts, you know, in entertainment history, where she went from being, you know, with Ike Turner, who is human garbage, and her escaping from that with, I guess, really only just the right to call herself Tina Turner still, and then clawing her way back to the, you know, already enormous success she'd attained by the early 80s, right? So she's bringing some of that with her. I think there's a term the Italian neorealists used when they were casting, you know, real people as characters in their films, and they talked about typage. You don't get someone who's an actor, you get somebody who fulfills the character type you're looking for. And I think there's some of that going on here. I think even if you didn't have Tina Turner playing anti-entity, you'd want somebody with some of that Tina Turner energy and sense of history to her.
Her energy's big. You know what else is big? Is her freaking shoulder pads.
and her chainmail dress.
Yeah.
And that wig.
Oh, the wigs in this movie. Oh, my God.
No, have you heard about how much that dress weighed?
Yeah, it was like 100 pounds or something, wasn't it?
It's something crazy. She got like 50 kilos worth of gear on her, and because it's chainmail, it would heat up. There's another great thing about Tina here that I love, is we get exactly the right amount of backstory.
Yeah, I do respect that. I like how Miller does not feel the need to give her a big backstory. I agree with you. That's a really good part of this film.
And also, weirdly, because this is the only film in the series where this happens a lot, is there are a bunch of either verbal or on-screen text references to other film titles. Because when Tina Turner talks about surviving the apocalypse, yes, what's the phrase she uses? On the day after I was still alive. Ah. And this film was shot, this would have been shooting in 84. So like, maybe not even a full year after the TV movie The Day After had aired. So I always appreciated that would be that's a nice cultural shorthand for the end of the world.
Well, speaking of backstory, Auntie's getting some info from Max, like the fact that he was a cop before and that she was a no one, but yet she's still alive. And we also get some dramatics involving Fruit until Max fights his way out and Tina congratulates him on being the first to, quote unquote, survive the audition.
God, yeah. It's a really fun scene, and it's weird that we haven't had any scenes of Max actually physically fighting people without vehicles or guns being involved before.
Yeah. Auntie says that she built the entire town, turning despair into hope, and that she will do all she can to protect it. She says she will offer him all that he wants, and today he needs to kill a man for her, and the reasons behind it shouldn't concern him, just the conditions. And my favorite part of Bartertown is the fact that it's run on methane gas being produced by these pigs. In this goddamn pen, which wasn't very sanitary. In fact, there was danger of this production being shut down because people were walking into the set wearing hazmat suits and you had pig shit everywhere. And that is how this town is being run. And I love that detail.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to be Irish and not to have had some kind of rural upbringing. And where I grew up like literally on the sort of fault line between this is where the suburbs end and right at the end of the suburbs are the farms. So every time I watch this, I can smell pig slurry. I know exactly what Bartertown smells like because it's, you know, it's, yeah, I would catch that scent on the wind, you know.
Matt, how do you feel about these details?
Well, given the fact I grew up on the same street as a dairy farm, our house was sandwiched in between a dairy farm and then my family's actual farm with cows, livestock, other stuff. This is a smell I know all too well, and this is a job I had done when I was a little child of shoveling pig shit. And there was no day that goes by after a long day of that where a bacon cheeseburger does not put a smile on your face.
I'm sure. All right, now, Mick, buckle up, and people out there, please buckle up. Matt and I are going to make a lot of wrestling references here in the next 5 or 10 minutes, because I got to tell you, Matt, I think this must be one of Dusty Rhodes' favorite freaking movies. I have to tell you, there's a lot of stuff he takes from this movie. Like, for example, when Max asks Anti, who he's going to be fighting, Anti points out that it's going to be Master Blaster. People know that Kevin Nash was a part of a tag team in his very first entry into wrestling as a part of the Master Blasters. And Dusty Rhodes has been on record as saying that he loved this movie, and a lot of his booking decisions from characters to cage matches came from the influence of this film. And we even have like the Spin the Wheel Make the Deal that was directly from like the Halloween Havoc pay-per-views that they did for a couple years. It's crazy how many different times I saw exactly what Dusty Rhodes was booking when I watched this movie. Max is told that Blaster can defeat most men just by breathing on them. When he says he doesn't know much about methane, Anti responds, "You can swallow shit, can't you?" And by the way, Mick, when I look at this design, and we've really complimented these designs and all the steam and things, this is what I think of when I think of steampunk. You?
It's not a go-to reference for steampunk, but it's definitely a bunch of design choices. I think about when anyone asks me to imagine kind of post-apocalyptic sort of civilization trying to get back on its feet. But okay. everything's made from something that had a previous purpose. And there's lots of attempts to try and recapture the grandeur of the old world. I think my favorite thing here is that I like in Border Town. You know, there's that little cafe.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a converted bus, so it's already like a dining, you know, it's already like, you know, a sort of long dining sort of truck vehicle, yes. But the sign on it says Atomic Cafe, and it's another one of this movie's film references. I don't know if you know the documentary Atomic Cafe. I always got a kick out of that. I always got a, ha-ha, I get that reference. I know what they're talking about. And I like the idea of somebody in the post-apocalypse remembering the 1982 documentary and naming their business after it.
This is the movie that I think a lot of things around this time owe a certain amount of credit to. Like, Mad Max in general, most of the Road Warrior and Beyond Thunderdome have had a huge impact on pop culture, both in pro wrestling and other stuff. I mean, how many movies in the 80s involved crazy, like, vehicle gangs? Even Weird Science, like, comedies had biker gangs, and that one of which was played by Vernon Wells. So,
so Max sees somebody with Pit Killer branded on him.
Okay, yeah, I imagine this is lost on everyone in North America, but the actor who plays Pig Killer, Robert Grubb, is about a year off becoming kind of a big name in TV. He becomes the lead of, there's an Australian TV show a little after this film called Flying Doctors, which is sort of an outback medical drama. You know, because the outback's so vast, you have to fly, you know, the doctors have to sometimes travel in planes, yes. And it's this show where Robert Grubb is, he's in it, he's the lead of that show, he's, you know, he's less grubby, you know, and he's a kind of, I think, a big city, recently qualified doctor having to serve in the outback, but he's great in that TV show and he's a really fun actor and he still turns up in lots of Australian stuff, but it's always a delight to see him in a film because I don't see him in many films.
Interesting. We see someone discover a ton of dynamite rigged to explode. I do like when Max walks in, Blaster goes, "Who are you?" And Max responds, "Me, Max." Like, "Who you?" He's like, "Me, Max." Mel is definitely more into it this time. I still hold true to my opinion that for a set of movies named after him, as I mentioned, Max is always the least interesting character in each of these films. For the most part, that pretty much holds true here, but I think Miller gave him more to do to make us feel bad for him. Like, for example, shovel shit.
Yeah. Also, I like the fact that, like, Master is played by Angelo Rosito, who, have you looked at that guy's filmography? Because he's in Todd Browning's Freaks.
Oh, my God. This is the guy from Freaks. Okay. And yeah, I remember reading that somebody here was from Freaks. That movie's from, what, like the 30s or something, isn't it?
Yeah, but his career goes back beyond that. He was working in the silent era.
Holy shit.
He's in multiple Cecil B. DeMille films. He's a little person in the greatest show on earth. He's in lots of, literally in almost any time you watch a Hollywood Roman epic from the 1950s, yes? If the emperor, whatever, has a little person at court, yes, he's there. His filmography is, like, it's about 100 movies. And a lot of them are these tiny little bit parts. But this is a guy who was, he died in the 90s. And I think his last movie credit was in, like, 87 or so. But he was there at the start. He was there in the silent era. I hope they got lots of stories out of him and somebody recorded them.
Max is lifted up, and I gotta say, boys, you know, I didn't remember really liking this movie. I'll get that off my chest right now. But so far, I am digging where we are. I am digging where we are. I'm digging what Max is doing. I am digging this movie. Matt, you've kind of alluded to the fact that this was kind of the quote-unquote Return of the Jedi for you, that this was the lesser of the three. Are you having a good time with this?
Yeah, so far? But it's funny. This is very much Jabba's palace, where it's, you know, despair. You got the characters working there against their will. There's a bit of a power struggle, and then, you know, they eventually leave here, and a lot of praise for Return of the Jedi goes to the Jabba's Palace sequence, the same way that Bartertown is held up in this movie.
Now, we get some glances from Auntie here, and Master Blaster makes Auntie say that Master Blaster runs Bartertown. This is just a weird dynamic, and Mick, I'm right with you where I'm glad we're not getting a backstory here, but we're kind of getting the result of it, right?
Right, but there's kind of a, there's kind of an implied backstory, right? Because Master is a little person, but he's clearly smart, he clearly understands engineering, right? And Blaster is huge, right? And we'll get to, you know, what we knew about Blaster a little later on, but you know how they found that actor, right?
No.
No.
He was a plumber.
Oh, speaking of Dusty Rhodes. Yeah.
He's a plumber in Sydney who just happened to be 6'8".
That is crazy.
They just found, who is the largest person we can find in this city? So he's not an actor, but he has the same name as an actual American actor, and I keep seeing them being credited as the same person on things like IMDb, and it's, But no, this guy was a plumber. And then I guess he took some time off from plumbing to, you know, to be the largest person you've ever seen.
Wow, that's incredible. God, where Miller finds these people. These stories behind a lot of these castings never ceases to amaze me.
One day you're a plumber in Sydney, yes. And you're unclogging U-bands, you're doing that stuff, yes. And then a few weeks later, somebody who had worked with Cecil B. DeMille, is riding on your shoulders. Whilst you're holding Mel Gibson in a chokehold. I mean, you know.
Blaster then learns that the vehicle he owns used to belong to Max. So he has Max disarm a booby trap, and in the course of doing this, he sets off an alarm, and we learn of a very important detail, that Blaster is very sensitive to sound. Nice little setup here. Max keeps telling the other workers that he's a nobody, and he just wants his camels and other supplies so that he can leave. Auntie then points out all the conflicts in Bartertown are solved in Thunderdome, where two men enter, one man leaves. And that he must fight his way out of it. We also learn that Chance decides whether or not there are weapons. Now, here's something I will say. I thought the Thunderdome played a bigger part in this movie, but this is literally the only time we see it. That's interesting.
But it's great. We don't need more than one Thunderdome sequence. I don't know what else you would do with it.
No, but why name the goddamn movie after it if you're not going to use it?
Because it sounds cool.
There you go. I guess so. So Auntie zips down Shawn Michaels style, saying, "Welcome to another edition of Thunderdome." And then we get some kind of monologue about Bartertown history. And I love how this is all getting really built up here.
Yeah, this film, like a lot of these movies, is full of people who are good at comparing. People who have just got really great emceeing skills. Auntie's great at it. This Dr. Dealgood guy, who, you know, we've seen doing auctions in Bartertown. And we see him doing the intro to Thunderdome. He's great as well. And there's more to come. Everyone is so good at doing their little spiel. I love it.
Yeah, I do too. Again, really good setup here. Really nice entry into this world. I'm really digging what's going on. So this monologue ends by the guy saying, "Dying time is here," as he introduces the two combatants, with Max specifically being called the man with no name.
Yeah. Do you see what he did there? Did you spot the subtle reference to another series of movies? It's very subtle. The man with no name, is it the Western? Yeah. Is it the Western thing? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I caught that.
It's the second time in this franchise that Max is being kind of consciously compared to that Clint Eastwood character. So, yay!
We see weapons getting placed on the cage, and Max is told, "I know you won't break any rules. There aren't any." So, here we go. The fight's starting off. They're swinging at one another. Matt, I feel like we're doing one of our wrestling podcasts here. I'm giving a blow-by-blow.
Yeah. Parts of this, I mean, this is TNA's Lethal Lockdown, where it's War Games, but they have a cage top where all the weapons are put on top. You have to climb up and get them, mixed with It's kind of like a strap match with them swinging into one another. It's almost like they're connected.
Yeah.
This fight scene is fucking awesome as far as how it's seen how it's edited. It's kind of unfortunate that this is nothing else in the rest of the movie, as good as the action is, can top this. It's the outlier in the Mad Max trilogy where the climax does not contain the best action scene in the movie.
We might fight about that later on.
It's such a fun concept that Miller basically revisits this in Babe Pig in the City.
Oh my god, you're right.
The end of Babe Pig in the City is kind of, yeah, it's Mrs. Hoggett kind of in a thing that basically turns into Thunderdome again, but even more so. Like, he clearly liked the idea of having people swinging around at each other in combat, that he recycled the idea and... Yeah.
What I do like about this, and Matt, you kind of skimmed over it, but the dramatics added by them being on bungees, that was badass. That's what gave me a real American Gladiators feel, was seeing them going around on these bungees like okay. this.
Do you guys, I don't know what children's playgrounds look like in your part of the world.
Not like this, I will tell you that right now.
Yeah, we don't have chainsaws on our at the top of our jungle gyms, Mick.
No. So here... and they went out of favor kind of like in the aughts. I haven't seen one of these in about 10, 15 years, but they used to have these little dome-shaped climbing frames for toddlers. Did you ever seen these?
Yeah, I've actually been on one, and I actually ruptured a kidney falling on one.
So that was last year.
Yeah.
So they used to have these dome-shaped little, we call them climbing frames, and when my son was very little, we had one of those bungee things that you attach to a door frame.
Okay.
You know, a little baby bouncer, yes?
Uh-huh.
So that they can, you know, bounce up and down and get used to using their legs. And
I love the way the story's being set up. Go ahead.
Yes. And I remember we had them in those, and I remember I saw one of these parks, and they had one of these dome-shaped climbing frames, and all I could think of was, man, if I can get my child and another child, and if it's two sets of those baby bouncers, we could just do this. We could just do toddler Thunderdome, you know. One baby enters, you know.
Two babies enter.
Two babies enter. Yeah, yeah. You know, disappointed I never got to do that in real life, you know.
Oh, I was hoping you would end the story like that. That's amazing.
I'm about to be father. I'm about so to be seeing... father of the week.
So we see Blaster throwing Max all around this dome and then clubbing him down. And once he gets Max down, he jumps a few times with Max at the bottom of his legs before giving him an Andre the Giant bear hug. This is good stuff, man. He runs at Max with a sword pointing at him, but Max moves and some poor soul just gets completely depleted.
Yeah.
And okay, so here's my big beef with this movie, a big gripe I have is, you know, those previous films, and Matt, you kind of talked about this when we were talking about the intros, but Miller would have those extreme close-ups and we'd see a ton of violence and blood, and we're not seeing it because we have a PG-13 rating here. And, you know, I could have used more of the danger that goes along with this fight because we have chainsaws coming into play. Matt, do you feel the PG-13 rating hurts this film?
Not in this instance. Because while the other movies were certainly more graphic, it was also presented very matter-of-factly, not necessarily in an exploitation manner. I don't think this is as bad as like what you would see with RoboCop 3, where that literally becomes a cartoon. Cartoon physics included. So this does not bother me, and I can't believe I'm saying that, because I'm normally a stickler for this type of for this type of shift. But I'm also looking at it in the context that this movie's presenting for the first half. This franchise has never craved bloodlust, so I don't feel like I should either. Like, if this was, let's say, like a slasher franchise level of traversal, I'd probably be more upset. But I don't think you come to a Mad Max movie for blood and viscera.
But the danger of it, and God, imagine if a Die Hard movie did, oh wait, it did do that.
Yeah. That's the perfect example.
Because
it's not just the violence that's toned down, it's the language.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Mad Max movies, the first couple, you know, there's a good amount of, you know, explicit dialogue, but I never felt like it was trying to be a Tarantino movie where every other word is fuck. So even here, where it's certainly more toned down, it just doesn't bother me. It's so weird. Like, this is very much an exception to the norm from my perspective.
I thought for sure we'd get like a 5-minute rant from you on this, and you feel the exact opposite. That surprises me. You never cease to amaze me, sir.
Well, the movie's not over yet.
Right. The sort of the softening of the violence in this, I often wonder how much this is connected to this movie's uncredited executive producer, if you've heard these stories.
Which is?
Okay. As soon as this movie came out, in fact, this is mentioned there's an issue of Rolling Stone around the time the film comes out where there's a sort of report from the set and an interview with Mel Gibson. And one of the things that's mentioned there is the rumors that Steven Spielberg is an uncredited executive producer.
No.
Yeah.
And, I got an Amblin feel from this.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely something coming up that feels straight out of the Amblin playbook.
Now, you know what? In the opening credits, one of the people who, like, important enough to this production to get a credit in the opening title sequence is Ed Vero. Do you know Ed Vero?
No.
Spielberg's storyboard artist and sometime production designer, and actually also somebody who was mentored by Chuck Jones. Ed Vero, fascinating career as a production designer and storyboard artist. And yeah, Ed Vero did a lot of design and concept work on this. And the story, the rumor is that Spielberg, when he was still at Warner Brothers, because you'll remember in the early to mid-80s, Spielberg had a deal with Warners and he had an office on their lot.
Yeah.
So apparently this is a film that he helped shepherd, but isn't credited on.
That's a crazy story. But he did have his name taken off a couple films in this era. I remember one, there's a frat comedy that he had shepherded.
There's a high school comedy, 3 o'clock High, that he had his name taken off. Yes.
Yes, that one.
And he's kind of made a couple of things happen, but asked not to be credited or mentioned.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he is the person who made the Child's Play sequels happen.
Oh, come on, Mick.
Yeah. Do you not know this?
No.
Spielberg, when he learned that MGM weren't going to make a sequel to Child's Play, urged Universal to buy the sequel rights.
Holy shit.
And said, that's a franchise for you. That's your Freddy Krueger. That's your slasher franchise. Go just pick up those sequel rights. Not enough to get mentioned as an executive producer, even if he'd wanted that. But, you know, Spielberg, he makes a lot of things happen just by having conversations with people. So,
and this was the height of his power, too. So,
yeah,
you know what? It would make sense because he did work with Miller on the Twilight Zone movie. So,
right, yes. And if you check out that Rolling Stone set report on this film,
mm-hmm.
There's a couple of things that now read very much like foreshadowing. Now, I remember reading this a while ago, but yeah, I think like the quote from Mel Gibson when he's asked if Spielberg was involved, he said, oh, I don't know about that, but it wouldn't bother me if he was. Why would it bother me? Dude, why would Mr. Mel Gibson be bothered by a famous Jewish person being involved in the production of his motion picture? And there's also references in it to Mel Gibson really wanting a beer and having a hard time on set because you're in the bleakest, most dangerous part of the art back and you just can't drink alcohol. So I'm like, these both feel very much like foreshadowing. It was all here, right? Just all being pointed out subtly.
Matt, you're going to have to finish the plot summary because my mind's officially blown for the previous 10 minutes. I am loving how this movie is shot with all the shadows roaming around, you know, as the fight is going on. This is good stuff. Max then spots this whistle. And he picks it up and blows it to distract Blaster, and then eventually takes off his helmet. When Max goes to finish him off, he sees that Blaster is just a man with the mind of a child, so he doesn't kill him.
Yeah.
What a reveal this is. As you mentioned, he's been roaming around. We haven't seen it. Now we are finally seeing that this is just a child, pretty much.
We can see now that basically the whole Master Blaster deal is kind of very much like George and Lenny and of Mice and Men. It's a symbiotic relationship between somebody who is, you know, somebody who's smart and somebody who's very, very large but has a developmental issue and would not survive by themselves.
Yeah, this is very well foreshadowed and actually paid off pretty well. So, yeah, this works pretty well for me.
Max says this wasn't part of the deal as Master questions Ante on what he means by that. Blaster has been killed by an arrow, and then Master mourns his death as Max heads out of the Thunderdome.
Yeah, we haven't talked about the person who shoots Blaster. The actor playing Ironbar, Anti-Entity's kind of main henchperson. He's an Australian rock star called Angry Anderson. I think Angry Anderson may be the only person in this film series whose real name is more Mad Max than the name his character in a Mad Max film he plays is It's the only time that happens.
The people chant, two men enter, one man leaves, as Auntie jumps down and loses it, saying she wrote the law and that Max has broken it. And I have to say, anytime they give Tina Turner a monologue, I'm fucking in. I love when she's just screaming kind of out of control here. It's great.
Yeah.
So since Max busted the deal, he must face the wheel. Another thing WCW would run with 7 years later. Max spins the wheel with Auntie looking on, and it lands on Gulag, right?
Gulag, yes. The thing I like about the, you know, that Auntie has reduced the judicial system in Border Town to things that are entertaining to watch and explained by simple slogans. And I always thought the bust a deal, face the wheel is kind of, yeah, that's inherently barbaric, but you can get anything like that by people if you've got like a catchy, you know, phrase and you make it seem simplistic. It's the three strikes rule. Look, there's a simple slogan. We don't want you to think about this being inherently barbaric or wrong. There's a simple slogan. You understand it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. We don't need to like get a real rundown of the rules. If they chant what's going on, then we really don't need a background of it. That's a good point.
Well, Border Town in general is basically an inverse of civilization in modern context, where a lot of it is patriarchal, masculine. Here it is all about domestication. They're all subservient to her. And she kind of represents control grid elitism, and that society will live on as long as it's means of control. And it's also telling her MC is a Freemason.
Yeah.
like that is very telling. Because this movie has a lot of subtext about, you know, social critiques. There's some philosophy later on. So even though it's a big Hollywood movie, it's got more in its mind than these kind of movies typically do. And it is... not necessarily surface level, but it's there if you look at it.
We cut to Max being led outside with a weird helmet on as...
Oh, God, this is going to be a weird, specifically kind of British-Irish reference I don't think is going to make any sense to anyone. In the Middle Ages, you used to have troops of people who would perform, like plays, and they were called mummers, and would travel from village to village. And you still kind of get this in sort of England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, people doing mumming. There's like basically six characters when you run the standard mummers show that they've been doing since the Middle Ages. And they made me do this at school. In my primary school, we had to do this every year. And one of the characters is Big Head. And you basically just have a large wicker or papier-mâché giant head that you put on a character. Okay. And that's it. It looks like it's just, I don't know where they got this head prop from, but it looks exactly like the big head prop they had in my school for whatever poor child was going to have to wander around with like 20 kilos of fiberglass or whatever on their head for the duration of the school play.
Now, Garrett, can I get my obligatory reference out of the way involving a show about fourth graders? This is one of the best references South Park has ever made. When they did the episode all about the election between the douche and the turd sandwich. And Stan is banished from the town. He's like, why am I going to vote? They both suck. So they put him on a horse, put a bucket over his head, and they leave him to wander the desert, and he's rescued by PETA members, which is kind of the equivalent of the kids. So I never realized South Park was referencing Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome until I saw this movie. And I'm like, good on you guys for keeping the dream alive, referencing that movie of all things.
Rescued by PETA members.
You gotta watch. It's one of the best episodes they've done. And that episode's like 20 years old at this
point. You know, of all things, this way of quote-unquote killing Max seemed weird to me. Because wouldn't Auntie have things that required the subject die in front of her? She's letting the desert do all the work for her here.
But her rule needs to make it seem as if it's she's not a full tyrant, right?
Yeah.
That there's an element of sort of chance or caprice to this, that you're spinning the wheel. It could have landed on just forfeit goods or amputation or one of the other things, and it just landed on, you know, exile. Though, in their case, it clearly is death, right? Because, you know.
Yeah.
Ordinarily, this would kill a person.
For sure. Meanwhile, Master is lowered into the pigs, Hannibal style. But, of course, this being PG-13, we see nothing. But they bring him up, and Auntie tells him to do what Iron Bar says. We see a monkey make its way out with something we'll see here in a bit. Meanwhile, Max's horse dies and falls, so add this to the tally of animals that George Miller has killed on screen.
Yeah. Animals shouldn't get involved with Max. It ends badly.
No. Max almost falls in before he crawls his way out of this sand trap and is met by the monkey, who gives him some water. He gets a bit further before collapsing again, and then we see somebody out making their rounds, I guess, come from the smoke and find Max. And folks, from this point on, we have an entirely different movie.
Yeah.
This is Savannah's movie from here on out.
This is Savannah's movie, and Helen Boudet, who plays Savannah, should probably actually be the second billed in this movie.
For sure.
And this is also where the movie starts to run into, there's kind of a controversy here. I don't know if you're aware of this. Are you aware of the author Russell Hobain?
No, sir.
You may be familiar with his book. I think he wrote Miss Frisbee and the Rats of Nim, which was turned into Secret Nim. I think that was him, yeah. But on this side of the Atlantic, certainly, he is best remembered for his book Ridley Walker. You don't know this? No.
No. What did he do? Try suing or something?
Well, I'll let you recap a bit further, but then I'll intrude and explain the Russell Hobain controversy.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, Russell Hobain's work is normally kind of respectable literary fiction, but Ridley Walker is a science fiction novel, and as often happens when people who work in respectable literary fiction write science fiction books, they think they're the first person to have ever come up with any of these ideas, even if they're dealing with things that are long-standing sci-fi tropes. So Ridley Walker is a book about a teenage boy, and it's set in the south of England many, many centuries after a nuclear holocaust, and language has changed. Ridley Walker is a book that's a very rewarding book to read, but by God, you will have to constantly stop and phonetically sound out every single line in that book, because everything is spelled differently, because English has kind of reverted into something that feels like a future form of Middle English.
Oh, wow.
So as soon as this character who finds Max turns up, this Savannah Nix that she's called, and as soon as we see that all of these kids speak in a strange, you know, post-apocalyptic version of English, that is a thing that raised Russell Hobain's hackles, because when he'd been on a book tour in the early 80s in Australia, his publisher had arranged for him to have dinner with George Miller, because his publisher, or at least his literary agent, thought, yes, you've written a post-apocalyptic book, you should meet the guy who made that post-apocalyptic film, maybe something will happen.
Wow.
So Russell Hobain, he's dead now, but he was forever salty about this whole business, because he seemed to think that people in a science fiction text speaking a new made-up language is an idea only he can have, and not a thing that kind of exists in lots of stuff.
So did he sue or no?
No, he didn't sue, but he couldn't sue. There's nothing actionable to sue over here, right? You can't sue over having created a trope, and plot-wise, Ridley Walker is not like Beyond Thunderdome at all. The thing is, of course, obviously, because the lost tribe of children in this, their messiah that they're waiting for, they call Captain Walker. So Russell Hobain obviously thought, well, this is directly lifted from my book, and he's cheekily stuck in this reference to Walker as well, just to, you know, that I don't think that's the case, and I don't see people discussing it, but there is another film that has Tina Turner in it, and where the plot kind of hinges entirely on somebody called Captain Walker going missing, and that is...
Yeah.
Tommy, you know, the rock opera Tommy, yes?
Oh, yeah.
The whole plot of Tommy is Captain Walker doesn't come home.
Yeah.
And I was kind of thinking about like this, well, I would love to, I hope somebody at some point sat Russell Hobain down and went like, yeah, you know, Clockwork Orange, you know, like literally every science fiction book everyone's ever written, language changes, you can't sue over this. And and George Miller's a big Ken Russell fan. He's homaging Tommy. He's put the Acid Queen from Tommy in his movie as well. He's homaging Tommy. I think that all seems so clear to me, but Russell Hobain, every interview he ever gave, every like public talk, he would complain about this, and I can understand why he thinks George Miller did him dirty, but I don't think he really has a case.
Yeah, I don't either. Boy, Mick, you're full of anecdotes today, sir. Interesting anecdotes.
Do you know what he did wrong, though? He shouldn't have had dinner with George Miller about turning that into a film. He should have had dinner with John Berman. Ridley Walker would make an amazing John Berman film.
Speaking of Tommy, if not George, if you're listening, it's not too late to put Elton John in a Mad Max movie. He would fit right in.
He would, yeah.
They maneuver through Tatooine, and we get, Matt, you thought you were away from Tatooine, and we get to where the Lost Boys are. Now, Matt, this is Peter Pan all over again, right?
You know, it's pure nature versus, they literally were supposed to be the Lost Boys, I think was the plan. I don't think it was a rights dispute, because I'm pretty sure Peter Pan is a certain kind, is public domain.
Oh, no, it would still have been under copyright in 85.
Especially because Disney had made a version. That's probably why they got around it. But yeah, I hate that I don't hate this inclusion.
Oh my God. I'm glad you and I are on the same page because I'm the exact same way.
I should hate this, but I think the reason why I don't is because, well, there's a lot of stuff we'll get into. So the second half of the movie, once Max is banished into the desert, he literally becomes Moses. Which I feel weird saying because it's Mel Gibson, but that's a special thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the kids live, you know, it's all about nature and harmony. You know, it's a direct contrast to Bartertown, where they survive on myth, not necessarily rules that are put in place. They worship artifacts, not necessarily people. And I like Max is Moses and Jesus in a way, because he's supposed to be a deliverer to people who are working on faith that's kind of in line with myth, because Bartertown's all about greed and technology. And Max fits right in, because as shown in Bartertown, he's the enemy of civilization as it has become. And he has embodied the noble mythic folk hero. Not just this movie, but the one previously. But what's also important to note is Max outright denies he is their savior initially. Mm-hmm. So I like that he doesn't warm up to this immediately. If he showed up and he's like, okay, I'll help you, then I would have turned on this completely. That would have felt out of character, because in The Road Warrior, it took him almost dying for him to actually agree to help those people move away from Lord Humongous. So I should hate this, but the way it's implemented actually works for me because of how it contrasts with what's been presented.
I thought for sure I was going to hate this. I remembered pieces of this. I remember this particular part of the movie from my first viewing of it. And I thought coming in, looking at it from a critical point of view, I was going to turn on it. But I don't. And what it does, Matt, it proves that maybe George Miller should have been the one to direct Hook and not Steven Spielberg.
That's actually not a bad comp, because George Miller, well, the weird thing about Hook is I like it up until he becomes Peter Pan again. Because I think when Robin Williams plays the I want nothing to do with this, not an abusive father, but he's certainly neglectful, I think that part works really well. It's when he becomes this inner kid again where I just turn on the movie completely and detest it. But yeah, you're right. But George Miller, even in his kid movies, there's a dark undercurrent. Babe Pig in the City is notorious for that. And his Happy Feet movies have a lot of religious allegory in them as well. So
I was going to say Happy Feet has a lot of it.
You know, there is a through line through all of his movies, even his more kid ones. Because I don't think this outright becomes a kid's movie.
Put it this way, this is a, certainly the MPA rating for this is PG-13, so I was kind of thinking, oh, could I have my child watch this? And decided, no, not really, you know, because just this whole, and not even the Bartertown stuff or the Thunderdome, it's just, I think how strange and sad the sequence is, and I think it's more the sort of sense of melancholy here that I didn't maybe want my child to actually want to see, at least not until they're older and better able to process it. Yeah,
it's still got some very deep thematic undercurrents to it that are just a bit above, you know, the sophistication of like your ages 6 to 10. Which is kind of the cutoff to where you can consider showing PG-13 movies to kids. But I think because of the sadness that's presented and just this world is very unbearing, even on this civilization of kids, that is just not appropriate for that age group. So I in a lot of ways, I think the PG-13 movie or rating kind of hurts this movie. And it's kind of the opposite of Temple of Doom, which is what this is often compared to. Same time frame. Now, Temple of Doom has a group of kids that he frees, but really, in that movie, he frees them from Bartertown. they're abused, and they're literally shoveling shit in that movie. So I think this works much better than it does in that.
Yeah, no, there's a couple of things. I like that when Savannah explains their whole cosmology to them, that they survived this plane crash, that all the adults left and no one came back, but Captain Walker said somebody would come back, and that they built this complicated mythology around that. I love this, because it's sort of, are you familiar with cargo cults?
No.
Right. This bizarre thing happened on multiple islands in the Pacific during and after the Second World War, where you've got all of these sort of chain of islands stretching from, you know, Hawaii down to New Zealand. So, you know, all these sort of Polynesian and Micronesian islands that weren't really geographically significant in the previous centuries. So the only contact they'd had with the outside world really had been like passing whaling ships, and then suddenly they became massively significant during the war, and a number of them were places where the American military built bases, and you know, they turned up with their airplanes and their radio towers and this, you know, mid-20th century technology. And the people on these islands who were incredibly smart people, yes, this is the thing. Even colonizing the Pacific Islands to so much smarts in terms of navigating and then being able to sail. And, you know, that's actually one of the great human achievements that we don't actually properly discuss. But when they encountered the superior technology, something about it, and like the same experience happened in multiple communities and multiple islands who weren't in contact with each other. But when the Americans went away, they missed them and thought that if we reconstructed radio towers out of bamboo, or if we cleared some of the brush and built a new airstrip, or if we built airplanes out of bamboo, that these people would come back. I remember reading about this, and I forget which island it was, but their whole belief system was that if we do this, their messiah, whom they had called John From, which is short for John from America, he would come back and he would bring them canned goods.
Oh, wow.
And this thing happened multiple times, right? So I kind of really like the idea of the children ending up with a sort of similar cargo cult-esque belief. I don't like it when people use cargo cult like as a shorthand for people being stupid or not understanding something, because I don't think that's what was happening here. But I think it's more that suddenly encountering this other civilization flipped a whole bunch of mythic switches in people's heads, and that this is the mood they went into.
Mm.
And it's fascinating, and I'll bet you George would have read all about this before they made it.
Guarantee it.
Do you know the story about the location for the crack in Earth where the kids are living? If you can track it down, there's an amazing documentary George Miller made called 40,000 Years of Dreaming. And it was, I don't even remember, around like 1998 for the centenary of cinema. The British Film Institute commissioned a whole bunch of documentaries from different filmmakers about their national cinema. And I think everyone's seen the Scorsese one on American cinema, which is amazing. But George Miller did one on Australian cinema, and he talked about his own career in it. And he has a story. And what he says is that when they were trying to make this and they were finding locations for the children to live in, this like oasis, that they had wanted to shoot in this location in Australia's Northern Territories, I think. But it was Aboriginal sacred land that nobody had ever been granted permission to film there before by the Aboriginal Council. And that he was advised that, look, you can ask, but they've said no to literally everyone who's ever asked for anything like this. But apparently Miller sent in somebody in with an interpreter and with storyboards of the film. I explained to the Aboriginal elders there what their film was about, what the previous films were about, how this story connected with the other stories. And what Miller says happened is when they had finished their presentation, the tribal elders spoke to each other for a little bit and then came back with, yes, we tell stories like this and we've told stories about men like this. And they granted him permission. Again, obviously, when you're in the business of making films that are very much presented as modern myths, you have an incentive to actually claim as much mythic lineage as you can. And I'm assuming that also extends to production anecdotes. But yeah, I'm assuming the story's on the level. So, storytelling got them the location.
Wow. We see the villagers start calling Max Captain Walker. We see Max in a white glow as the kids start trying to wake him up. They try getting Delta Fox X-ray up and going as one of the kids finds a Bugs Bunny pull toy I used to have as a kid.
Ah!
Yeah.
Have you heard about the Warner Brothers product placement thing they had going?
No.
From like the 80s onwards? Okay. So apparently, this is what I've read. I don't know if it applied to this, or if it was just like a thing they were able to use and it worked out. But apparently Warner Brothers at some point issued this edict that all of their films and TV shows should try and have some kind of Looney Tunes product placement if possible.
Oh,
or some
wow.
Warner Studio product placement, yes. So you've got things like, do you remember the TV show Babylon 5?
Yes, of course.
Yes, so a TV show set in, what is it, the 23rd, 24th century?
Uh-huh.
And you have one character, Garibaldi, who's really into Daffy Duck. And the only reason that happened is because that was one of Warner TV's edicts at the time, was that you have to have some Looney Tunes product placement in this for brand synergy. I often wonder whether that was actually something that happened here, or if it was just a George Miller going, you know, I can use Warner Brothers stuff. This would be a fun item to have.
Yeah, Joe Dante talks about that too when he talks on the Gremlins 2 commentary. He gets into that where it was kind of an edict where he had to include Looney Tunes there somehow. So they have a whole thing in the beginning of that film. All right, Matt, I couldn't crack you on the kids. Can I crack you on seeing the cutting of Max's hair?
Yes, because I hate this in movies where we have to do some kind of cosmetic makeover, this trope. So the only justification, if I'm looking at this from a theological perspective, is the Kether, which is Ancient of Days, also means crown of white hair. When he's given a new name, that's why they give him a white crown of hair, as that connection. But I hate when people get haircuts in movies. I fucking hate it. Or we have to explain it, Lex Luthor, Charles Xavier. I hate this trope so much.
I think we might see it in a couple weeks again, too.
Yeah, well, that's also because, hey, we have to, that's the one time we have to follow continuity.
So Max is then hung Ewok style. They cut the rope as he rises out of the water and the kids mimic him, which was a funny scene. I do feel this is the only time this whole series we really see Mel, a.k.a. Max, interact with people, and we get a lot of charm that Mel himself would become known for later. Obviously, 2 decades later, not so much, but we're seeing a lighter side of Mel that we hadn't seen in the previous two films.
Yes, and he's had a symbolic baptism.
For sure. The kids say that they've been waiting for Max, and we get this whole backstory from Savannah, which Mick dived into earlier, who talks about a past full of pain and that they were the survivors of a crash 747.
I love the fact that, A, they've got the cave paintings on the wall to help Savannah do the tell, as they say.
Yeah.
But I also love the fact that she's got that big wooden frame on a pole that she uses to move from picture to picture, and that the frame is 1 to 2.40. Her frame is in the CinemaScope aspect ratio. Which I love. I love the fact that she's, their story frame is widescreen.
What I will say about this scene, though, is I did have to turn the subtitles on because I kind of lost track of what she was saying halfway in. It was kind of hard to follow. I could see why people would rebel against a scene like this.
Oh, no, I love this scene so much. Here's the thing. Exposition is usually terrible. And this is a really great, fun exposition scene. And it works because it's organic.
Although, if we're going to make the comparison to the Ewoks, I think the Ewoks had a bigger part of Return of the Jedi. They tied up the rebels, and they were more of a stumbling block. Here, these kids aren't really stumbling blocks. They're just kind of here.
Yeah. Here's the weird thing, because obviously this is a film where they've hired lots of children, yeah? So a couple of these kids just never stop being in Australian television. Ever.
Really?
Yeah. Well, one of the smaller children is Rebecca Amigaldo, who is in the long-running soap opera Neighbours. She was also in the other soap opera Home and Away. So just a person who's just constantly in work and on Australian TV screens for like the next 40 years. And the sort of secondary female character of the children, Anna Guana, is the character name. It's like a little 9 or 10-year-old who's running around. That actress, Justin Clark. Again, you know, she's in lots of other Australian TV things, but she's also a children's TV presenter in Australia when she becomes an adult. So, I don't know how Australians can watch this film without going, oh, yeah, there's, you know, just without constantly doing, you know, the Leo DiCaprio meme. You know? it's astonishing how many of these kids just are in constant employment for the next 4 decades.
Crazy. Matt, how do you feel about this exposition scene?
It's about as effective as you can do it, but it also does still reflect the idea that these movies are, you know, legend and folklore. Because they're literally reenacting this story because they think he's savior. So I think it's a good reflection. It honestly doesn't bother me.
Now, there's a legend out there that Ogilvy was in charge of directing the kids and Miller was in charge of directing the adults. Miller has come out since and kind of debunked that theory, saying that they did most of the stuff together. But God, it must have been a pain in the ass to direct these kids. Mick, you've heard that, right?
Yeah, I think the best thing here is, you know, normally when you direct children, but one of the tricks they do, especially in television, is can we get identical twins to play the same child character?
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of the Mary-Kate and Ashley, yes. I guess, is the best example of that. But this is kind of like a weird flip side of that, where it's, what if we had 2 directors? Yeah. What if there's another? Yeah, that's the, you know, instead of finding, you know, I guess you can't find 24 sets of identical twins to be the tribe. Yeah.
That's quite a scouting.
You get 2 Georges. Yeah, get 2 directors called George, and they can both just, you know, split. Yeah, because if they're under 16, you can only have them on set for X number of hours per day.
Savannah says while some went to seek help, they never returned. They believe that Max is the walker sent to fix their airplane so they can go to the fable known as Tomorrow Morrowland.
Yeah. When I was a teenager, I thought this was implausible, that the kids wouldn't understand what had actually happened and would have so quickly lost any cultural memory of the world that existed before. But around about 2010, I had to try and show a teenager how to use a VCR. And no, now I buy this all completely. It was like, literally, what is this? How does this work? Where do I stick this? Yeah. I now completely buy this. I think it would take like 3 weeks, to be perfectly honest, for them to develop their own cosmology and forget the old world.
That's funny. I do have to say, I used to have one of these viewfinders as well. We had the Bugs Bunny earlier. These viewfinders, I had one of these that he looks through and they wind it up a bit.
There's a detail when he looks through the viewfinder. You spotted this, yes?
What's that?
The eye that Max injures in the second film no longer dilates.
Oh, yeah, I did notice that.
Yeah, George Miller made Mel Gibson wear a contact lens for this shoot so that the eye looks... You can see it in a bunch of shots, but not all of them. But yeah, it's got that David Bowie thing. You know, it's the eye injury David Bowie had where his eyes weren't actually different colors. It's just one of them, the pupil was permanently dilated because he'd been injured in a fight when he was a kid. And I think it's with this one of his eyes, it's just the pupil's always not responding correctly to light.
Yeah, a good detail added by Miller there. Max then gets up and says they have the wrong guy. He talks about cities and skyscrapers before the epoxy eclipse happened, but the bottom line is he is not Captain Walker. As he flings the hat, well, what exactly happens here? I kind of lost track.
Coincidentally, a gust of wind catches the hat.
Okay.
And it goes up into the air, and these children seem to believe that Captain Walker's arrival will make the wind return to the engines of the plane. Yes, they talk about catching the wind or something.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's what they think is going to happen. And they throw in a reference to another Australian film during her monologue. There's an Australian film called Mouth to Mouth, one of John Duggan's first films. Let us never speak of John Duggan again, because there is a person who's a terrible human being who... Miller would produce a couple of other films Duggan made, so I'm assuming he's a fan and that was deliberate, but...
We get a sort of montage of these kids running through the desert with Max lingering behind. They come upon the fallen plane, big orchestral score this time, which I liked. And this scene of these kids on this plane is kind of haunting when I look at it.
The remnants of the old. And it's that thing that Tina Turner's character does, giving people hope. That's kind of what this is, you know, it's the preservation of previous life. Because they also look at science in the way that people criticize religion. They just call it the knowing. Like, you just have to believe. But it's also that piece of self-destruction, because an airplane is only as good as the pilot that's flying it.
Mick, how do you feel about the score this time? It's bigger than last time, isn't it? A bigger score.
Yes, it's a bigger score, and it's a score by somebody we've heard of. As the previous films were scored by Australian composer Brian May, who is not to be confused with Brian May of Queen. The guitarist of Queen and qualified astrophysicist, if you didn't know. What happened is that Brian May, the Australian composer, asked for too much money.
Jesus.
After the second film, he got himself an agent in Los Angeles and thought, yay. So he was asked back to do the score for the third film, but Chard was asking for what's purportedly an obscene sum. So Miller didn't know who to replace him with, but had a conversation with his friend Peter Weir. Peter Weir, as ever, Peter Weir, every time I hear about George Miller getting advice from Peter Weir, it always seems to be extremely sage-like. Peter Weir had done a number of films at this point with Maurice Jarre as a composer. So I think in the same calendar year we have Witness. Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Jarre had also done The Year of Living Dangerously. And
okay.
And basically, Peter Weir said, oh, God, well, you can trade up now. Go hire Maurice Jarre. He's amazing. And hiring Maurice Jarre allows George Miller to do this other thing, because there's a big influence on this film we haven't discussed, but becomes very apparent. And Maurice Jarre helps him lean deeper into that. And it's Lawrence of Arabia.
Can you imagine? Your star doesn't really ask for too much more money, or if he did, it doesn't seem too astronomical to not put him in the film. But your composer ask for more money. That's crazy.
You know, it's the thing as well, is your composer is certainly with what Brian May brought to the first two films, or certainly I think the second one's gotten a very efficient and effective score. But I don't know if it's memorable. I don't know if it's iconic in the way some film scores are.
No. I said in those podcasts, that's not... I mean, I think the second one's a little bit of an improvement over the first, but not much.
No, but this, it's a big trade-up. And even when the film's tonally going into places that some people object to, and the score's doing a lot of that as well, with the score's being kind of very hopeful and optimistic once we get to the kids, I still think there's some great stuff going on in the score and a lot of different musical textures and sounds. And yeah, it's weird, though, because it doesn't much resemble the score for Lawrence of Arabia, though there's a whole bunch of Lawrence of Arabia kind of shots in this film.
Yeah.
It does resemble the score Maury Shore did for, there's a film from the 60s called The Train. Do you know it?
No, I didn't know he was been scoring for that long. Wow.
Yeah, there's a John Frankenheimer World War II film called The Train with Burt Lancaster in it. And it's amazing. Yeah, Burt Lancaster is a French resistance worker plotting to stop Nazis stealing art treasures from Paris as Paris is falling to the Allies. The train's amazing. The train is also very much like Die Hard on a train. Because you've got basically this posh German antagonist.
Is it better than Under Siege 2?
It's definitely better than Under Siege 2.
Okay. What a bar.
Great. But the score for the train in this, there's a lot of overlap.
Okay.
But the train's amazing. God, yeah, you need to see the
train. I'll check it out.
Yeah, it's Burt Lancaster being super athletic as well and doing lots of crazy stunts.
Interesting. So Max ends up, even after hearing the story, he ends up just turning around and walking away. We cut to inside the village. Max is sitting with his monkey and his stick as the kids look on, and they start to debate whether Max is Captain Walker or not. Max then warns the kids of Bartertown. He grabs a shotgun and shoots, saying that he's not Captain Walker. He then says that they're going to live here and be thankful. Spears are then thrown at him as he runs up, and actually, he punches Savannah in the face.
I've got to say this right now, just... the sequence in this film where Mel Gibson punches out a young woman plays very, very differently now.
Yeah, that was my next note, was given what we found out about him later, this is a damn disturbing image to see.
Sure. Yes, yes. Now that we know he's a domestic abuser, you know. Yeah.
Aside from the obvious art, unfortunately, reflecting reality, I'm perfectly okay with Max still being... it's like he's spent so much time in the wasteland, he doesn't want to go back because he's scared of losing it all again. This whole franchise has been cyclical. You know, we lose civilization, it gets rebuilt, mm-hmm. but it's flawed. This still feels in line with what he would do.
We cut to morning. Max is woken up, and he's told that he needs to help find the kids as they've disappeared. He follows some to the desert and gathers a group of the kids to go find the separatists as the other kids look on. They trek through the desert, with Max even carrying one of these kids on his shoulders at one point. He sees a few of them get sucked into the gulag and pulls the rest to safety. So why is he going to Bartertown again? He's going back here
because some are stuck there?
Because he knows that Savannah Nix is going to continue trekking. They think that, well, Max must have come from somewhere, so there must still be somewhere else out there.
Okay, and
they know that if they continue tracking past where they found him, they'll eventually stumble upon Bartertown, and, well, no good will come of that.
Yeah, and as Matt said, they are out of supplies, too. But I just find it weird that we're going underground here, we're going through this sewer, and this whole part of the movie is just weird to me.
It gets Gilliam-esque.
Yes. Oh, I thought of Gilliam a lot during this. They make their way through the underworld as one of the kids reminds me that it's jerkin' time. And Max tells the kids to shut up as he looks for Master. And we mentioned the F word earlier, but I love the use of fuck here. I really did not expect that when we actually hear it.
Yeah, I think real Australian children would swear more.
The kids swing through the pigs and capture the Master. We then see them go down a Goonies-type slide, which came out the same year. We then see the chainsaw make another appearance as they shut the door. Lots of swinging and blowing of horns. One guard emerges from shit. Auntie is pissed as she says that they're not going to hide anywhere. They need to bring the man back alive. No mercy.
Well, the guard emerging from the effluent, it's Iron Bar again. And this is now, what, the second time in the film Iron Bar has survived a thing that would definitely kill a person?
Yes.
Which is this whole deal. And there's some more Iron Bar trivia, apart from him being played by the Australian rock star Angry Anderson, who's definitely not famous outside Australia. He's named after a politician. There was an actual politician in Australia who got the nickname Iron Bar because of the time he assaulted somebody with an iron bar.
Oh, Christ.
Australia!
And wouldn't you know it, we're 75 minutes in, and we have some vehicles, and we are in the midst of a vehicle chase without a plan. It took 75 minutes to get here. But they're upping the stakes, because now, instead of a big rig or a car, we're on a train.
Yeah, and we have child endangerment.
But it's not even a train, it's a giant truck on train tracks. It's not a train, they literally got a prime mover. It's on train tracks, so it's not even a train that's supposed to be on train tracks. They modified, you know, a large road vehicle and put it on that. Hired the same truck driver from Road Warrior.
One of the making ofs I watched did say that they were filming this scene, and when an actual train was coming, they had to move it off really quick. So even though they have more money, they're still doing a lot of guerrilla filmmaking here.
Yeah.
Max helps some kids get Delta Fox X-Ray to work by Primitive. And this chase, I'll go ahead and say, I think is pretty badass. Now, Mick, you were, or one of you guys, maybe it was Matt, you said the end chase isn't that good of a scene.
No, I didn't say it was bad. I just said, you know, I think the Master Blaster fight is the best set piece in the movie.
Yeah. I've seen people complain about this end chase scene, and they always complain about weird stuff that they've misunderstood. One of the big key bits in it, when Max finally gets a vehicle, when Max hops off the train and kind of punches someone out and steals their car, it's a big vehicle that I've seen people refer to as the cow car, because it's kind of like covered in sort of a Frisian cattle skin. You know, it's got that white and black pattern on it, and the driver of it is wearing, you know, a Stetson. And I've seen people complain about how goofy the cow car looks. And I'm like, yeah, it's a complicated visual action set piece. And none of these cars really have chassis anymore or paintwork. So you want your hero car to be visually distinctive in some way. And Max hopping into the craziest, most wacky races looking car there is kind of, I think, works for that sequence.
Yeah, I agree with you. And also, saw in that making up, Tina Turner did her own driving here. She's actually driving this vehicle.
Yes, but they had to convert it to be an automatic.
Yes.
Because Tina Turner, in a thing everyone else in the world gets to mock lots of Americans for, couldn't drive stick. And you can't pass your driving test where I'm from if you can't do that.
Really?
Yeah, they really, I mean, unless you've got some kind of prior condition where you have to have an automatic. In fact, you know, automatics are so rare here, you know, so everyone here knows how to drive stick.
That's interesting. That's not true here. Matt, what do you think?
Well, most people in America can't drive, period.
You're not wrong.
Yeah, I think this is cool. There's nothing negative. Even in a movie like this, which is certainly bit toned down in certain respects, it still feels like a Mad Max movie.
Oh yeah, and we're getting super close-ups of things exploding, and we're getting a lot more stunt work that we've been complimenting this entire series. Yeah, it still feels like a Mad Max film for sure.
There's kind of two things with the stunt work here though that we sort of need to address. One is, because they were shooting deeper into Australia's interior, the vehicles couldn't go as fast. If you've heard this,
I have heard this actually.
Yes, because because there's so many small rocks and pebbles along the surface. Not part of the desert, that they couldn't go much over 40 without just things getting pelted, you know, without cameras and vehicles and people getting pelted with little small rocks. So the vehicles aren't going as fast. If you're doing this on a road, you can just go crazy. And the other is Angry Anderson again, the performer playing Iron Bar. You know about the accident he had on this, right? No?
No.
Okay. And this must have been awkward, because apparently Angry Anderson and George Miller are friends, but for some of the steam coming out of the train, they were using dry ice, and ordinarily dry ice wouldn't burn, is my understanding. It wouldn't give you a burn, but because they're in the desert and everything's evaporating so fast, apparently this somehow changes the properties of dry ice. I don't understand the chemistry behind this, but apparently he was supposed to, there's a shot where he's supposed to hang and then just get blasted with the dry ice that's supposed to be the steam, and he actually did get horribly burned from that. So, embarrassingly, wow. I guess, for Miller, one of the injuries on this film is someone who was a friend of his whom he'd cast. And the other thing is, I guess, having already used up all the actors in Australia, they had to go back and hire his stunt coordinator from the first Mad Max film, and they hadn't brought back for the sequel because they needed everyone. So this is a film where it's like every stunt performer in Australia is here right now.
Auntie boards the train as the pin to the car is pulled, and then Max boards after her. Max tries to help Pit Killer, who's been shot with an arrow through the door. Another kid claims, this is a stick-up, and everybody unboards the train.
Can you see? I was watching this, I want to say on Blu-ray, but I ripped the Blu-ray to the hard drive of my computer. Come at me, Major Studios, come on. But... If you're watching this film in anything like high definition or upwards, you'll notice that those shots where Tina Turner is on the train, and it is Tina Turner on the back of the train, yes, but you can see the safety cables in one or two shots.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah, but still, you wouldn't ordinarily, I guess, if you were watching this at the time. I think somehow watching it on a smaller screen in pin sharp detail just kind of reveals flaws that mightn't have been evident.
You know what, man? Putting the superstar singer on the back of a train like this is still pretty damn ballsy and awesome at the same time.
It is, yes.
They follow the kid into the fort, and it's inhabited by Bruce Spence. Return of Bruce Spence, he's back. Max tells them that they're going to board his plane. They do so, but the plane won't get up off the ground. So Bruce Spence is back, and he's playing Gyro again, or is this still a different character?
It's a different character, but wow. You know that hole in the ground he lives in?
Yeah.
You know that's somebody's actual lodgings?
Really?
Yeah, you know where they shot this? It's so deep in the Australian interior. It's a place called Cobberpeddy, and it's so hot that most of the time you can't even be outside.
Wow.
There's lots of sort of precious jewels to be mined or found there, and it's the only reason humans even go out there. But basically, it's so hot you have to constantly keep rehydrating yourself, just constantly. And the people who do live there, kind of like there's a bar in the town, and it's all underground. There are some subterranean habitations there simply because it's too hot on the surface. And yep, the Bruce Spence sequence where they go into his where he lives, that's somebody's house. Australia, you know.
Yeah, right. That sounds like the Nevada desert right now, because it's hot as hell.
Oh, God.
It's been triple digits the last couple days.
I saw the weather reports, and like it was hitting 50 Celsius. I've been in 48 Celsius once, and I thought I was going to die.
Max gets in a car as the kids go on the runway, and Max plays another game of chicken as he jumps off, and the plane takes off to safety.
The shot of Max on the ground, the camera tracking back as the plane swoops off and away, and it's totally a visual lift from Lawrence of Arabia, right? I didn't even bother checking my Lawrence of Arabia DVD, but like, yeah, this is lifted from David Lane, right?
Meanwhile, Auntie approaches Max as he wakes up and calls him a raggedy man and tells him goodbye. So we don't kill Auntie here. That was an interesting choice.
No, but Iron Bar clearly dies, we think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's dead. Matt, you're a fan of keeping villains alive. Were you happy with this decision?
Yes, because it would have been... I'm sure there was a certain clause in the contract where she couldn't die. I think it might have been one of those things, just a small shred of vanity. But also, if she was a man, they probably would have killed her off.
You think so?
Possibly, but in a movie that's a little bit more toned down, I don't think you would have killed off your villain. At least, that's kind of how I feel.
It's the first time the villain in these movies hasn't died in a head-on collision with Max.
Definitely.
Or caused by Max. Yeah, it's a weird one.
It just makes you wonder, like, was Miller having plans to bring these two back?
No, I think it's just kind of more like, right, I mean, I remember reading a review of this, or at least an article about this film, where they said that Bordertown isn't evil as such, more just profane and flawed. So I'm thinking, Anti-Entity clearly does a whole bunch of stuff that's morally wrong, right? But is she the same caliber of villain as the Toe Cutter or Lord Humongous? Would audiences really want to see her getting, you know, blown up or squished or whatever? Or do we just kind of have to go, well...
They're still out there.
They're still out there.
We cut to the plane flying through the air as a voiceover from Savannah this time tells us that they remember who they were and where they came from. And they remember the man who gave them salvage, and they like the city for him, and all salvages who will see the distant light will be coming home. This is very similar to the end of the previous film, which was told by the Fural Boy. And now we have Savannah telling this. Matt, did you like the fact that we're kind of ending it the same way?
He rides off into the sunset, likely never to be seen again. It's kind of that same ending. But also, I think it's very important for the movie to end in Sydney, of all places.
Yeah, I love the model shots for the ruins of Sydney. I like that whole sequence, that it's kind of sort of slightly surreal and dreamlike. And it's the first time we've had that kind of big sort of a kind of big effect sequence in one of these films.
We then get a credit for Byron as credits roll on Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. I gotta say, boys, this was one of the shortest plot summaries I ever had, but it turned out to be a very lengthy, very introspective discussion.
Yes, and the pop song plays.
Oh, yeah.
Which is such an 80s thing. I mean, we can joke about the hair, but nothing's more 1985 about this movie than the fact that a pop song like that plays over the end credits.
Well, the only thing
that
was missing was for them to do, like, Top Gun, where it's a shot from the movie and it freezes, and it says, yeah. actor as Quank.
And here's the thing, right? Because this song, We Don't Need Another Hero, is a huge hit in 1985. The song is inescapable, right?
Very much so. It's still inescapable, like I said at the beginning of the podcast.
Right, but it's kind of, you know, we get lots of songs from films in this decade. You couldn't make a big studio film this decade without also having a hit song that would have clips from the film and the video when it plays on MTV and that whole shebang. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of them that I kind of, the songs endure, but the films are forgotten, right? Like, oh God, what's that Phil Collins song? Against All Odds.
Oh, that's from, yes. Yeah, from Against All Odds.
Yes, and no one remembers that movie, right? Has anyone even seen that movie? And yes?
I saw it a long time ago.
Right, but that song, because it's about universal things, can be played at any time, yeah? Obviously, We Don't Need Another Hero's kind of has specific references to the Thunderdome in it. It's hard to uncouple that song from this film and use it in another context.
Man, you know what? My dad would play this song so much back in the day. And like I've said, I've heard this song a million times. So, all right. Scale of 1 to 10. What do we give Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome? Mick, you are wound up very much today, sir. What do you give this movie?
I think it would be fair if instead of me picking a number, I had a large wheel with 10 possibilities on it that I could spin, because really we take our chances with ratings, you know. I should just spin it and but I don't have one of those, and it's too late in the day for me to construct one from parts. So you know, the problem is if you give it a number, you sort of end up having to do these comparative things as if it's something we can measure scientifically, like temperature. And I think this film kind of resists that, because there are definitely flaws, but at the same time, there's lots of greatness. But also, we can't discuss it without comparing it to the film that preceded it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to uncouple those. So on balance, and I think mostly because of the world building and the confident strangeness of it, and how entertaining I find Tina Turner's performance, I think all of the things push it up to almost a 9.
So an 8.5.
Like more like an 8.7.
Wow. You know, considering you gave last week's movie a 10, I didn't know if you were going to go 9 or not. But all right, Matt, another one who gave last week's movie a 10. What do you give this movie,
I think,
sir?
The thing that hurts this movie in retrospect for a lot of people is having to be the follow-up to the Rogue Warrior, much like Return of the Jedi. It's got the problem of, well, it's no Empire. Unlike that movie, though,
yeah.
I actually think Beyond Thunderdome is a good, I would even argue, great conclusion to this original run of Mad Max movies, because it keeps the door open for another movie, but also does feel like a satisfying conclusion, because as a trilogy, Civilization rebuilds in contrast with the first movie where it falls. Second movie is all about if decency still exists in the world. This is one all about whether or not art and entertainment can carry over into a new civilization, especially with Barter Town. And for something that I normally resent, inclusion of kids and toning down the violence, I don't think it's as much of a detractor and factor in the movie as a whole. It's just in comparison to the other movies. So I think this movie is actually pretty underrated. And I think it gets a certain amount of hate that I feel is unwarranted. And I'll go as far as say I think this is the second best of the original three movies, because I like the interpretation of Max more as a folk hero, not necessarily a fully fleshed out three-dimensional protagonist. And this movie still functions like the Road Warrior does in that way. So I'm going to give this a soft 8. I think it's a lot of fun, but to quote what I said earlier, yeah, it is no Road Warrior, but I still think it's pretty damn good in its own right, and I think it's worth a revisit, especially with a new movie that just came out. I hope people rediscover this one and realize it's not as bad as its reputation. And it's nowhere near as kiddified as perception would lead you to believe.
You know what? I'm going to agree with you, and I'll take it one step further and say this is my favorite of the series so far. I like this better than last week's movie, and that shocks the hell out of me. This has been a series of surprises. Hell, this has been a year of surprises, because Matt threw Planet of the Apes on me, and most of those movies surprised me with how much I liked them. I came into this viewing not having very good memories of this movie, and like I said, I'd only seen it once. I think By that time, I was exhausted of Mad Max, though, because I'd seen the previous two back-to-back, and I watched this right after, and I was kind of done with it and kind of tuned out. But here, I'm enjoying the parallels between Peter Pan and this world. I'm enjoying what George Miller is bringing as far as not just action, which he pretty much always steps up for, but for depth to a Mad Max character that I have been begging for since the very beginning of this series. I think Mel Gibson is much better here. Even given the fact that they give this movie to Savannah halfway in, I'm having fun. Tina Turner's auntie, you know what? I could have used more of her, but I think the fact that he leaves you wanting more is a good thing. So I want to move it a positive point up just for that reason, where a lot of times we see villains like this, it's like, okay, we've seen enough, and sometimes it's overkill, and you're done with them, and they still throw it down your face. Here, wanting more is a very, very good trait to have as a director, and George Miller definitely does that here. So I'm not going to go quite as high as Matt. I want to go 7.5. So it's a half point higher than last week's movie. I enjoyed last week's movie and last week's car chases, but not much as far as depth of character and things like that, which I look for in movies. But I still had a pretty good time with this, and I was so not expecting that. So count this as yet another surprise. 7.5 out of 10. All right, go ahead.
I realized I had promised a Tina Turner production anecdote, and I feel bad even mentioning it, so I'm going to preface this by saying there's a lovely remembrance of Tina Turner that George Miller wrote for the UK newspaper The Guardian when she passed.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
That you should all check out because it's lovely, and I think this is also nice, and I don't mean this in a snide way, but I did once have a conversation with Brian Gibson, the director of Tina, What's Love Got to Do With It, the Tina Turner biopic. And yeah, I asked him about that, and he had nothing but nice things to say about Tina Turner, but he said they only ever had one disagreement with her about the film that took them a while to kind of talk her out of, which was that she was originally insisting that the film begin with one of Tina's past lives in ancient Egypt, where she was a queen, and that they managed to talk her out of that. But do you know what? I remember at the time hearing that story and going, oh, that's so funny, celebs, but at this point, I'm like, you know, normally when people tell these past life stories, it's they were something greater in their past life than they are now. And I think being Tina Turner and the life that Tina Turner had is way better than being Queen of Egypt.
Than being a Queen of Egypt.
And yes, I think that's much better. So I think maybe that makes the story more plausible. And I would also kind of add, if holding any of that kind of mythic idea in her head helped Tina Turner get through all of that awful earlier phase of her career and all of that trauma, good. You know.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely a presence and somebody who I can't imagine the 80s without her, honestly. So, yeah, very, very sad departure. And you're right, I read that article as well that Miller
it's so did moving.
In The Guardian. It's very respectful, very well done. So I recommend people check that out as well. I have a pretty good feeling that this podcast is going to recommend next week's movie. You know, I mean, in the 9 years since, it's been called one of, if not the best action movie of all time. You know, I said in that first podcast, I remember watching it, and I remember being impressed by it, but not nearly as impressed as my comrades and people in the industry. I'm not going to say reservations about next week's movie. I kind of feel like a movie that we're going to get to, Matt, The Last Jedi, where you're going to come in probably on a different plane than everybody else. I'm kind of feeling that way next week. I don't know what to expect when we get to next week's movie. I know it's going to be as lengthy a discussion as this one, if not more, because there's so much to it and so much production history. But, Matt, what do you expect when we discuss Mad Max Fury Road next week?
Well, is this the record as far as retrospectives we've done with the longest gap between movies?
I think so.
If you did Planet of the Apes, you've got like a 30-year gap.
That's true. Well, yeah, actually a little less because it's
between,
I think
27-year gap between Battle for the Planet of the Apes and the awful Tim Burton remake. Yeah.
But I also like, you know, Planet of the Apes. There were TV shows. I'm trying to think of like something being dormant. Basically, I'm expecting a bit of fireworks. Because for the longest of time, it was always like widely considered, with the exception of Garrett, the Road Warrior is the best movie in this series. I know very few people outside of Garrett who would argue the first one or the third. Fury Road came out and actually caused legitimate debate if it was not just the best Mad Max movie, but the best action movie ever made. Almost instantly when it came out, that was a common conception. And I think it's one of the movies that's responsible for the Oscars getting a bit more inviting towards genre films. Because I never thought a Mad Max movie would be nominated for Best Picture, let alone a new Mad Max movie actually getting released. So I'm excited to go back and watch this, because it has been a hot minute.
You know, Warners did actually do a Best Picture campaign for Road Warrior?
Did they really?
Well, yeah, it's kind of won because it's a better movie than Chariots of Fire.
Oh, God, yeah, no, they did. They at the end of 82, they got Road Warrior into art house theaters again, and they actually ran a four-year consideration campaign for Miller for Best Director and it for Best Picture. And, yeah, it's funny, there's a joke in an episode of Cheers where we learn that Fraser has definitely seen the film The Road Warrior. And I like to think that's a reflection of them getting it into art house cinemas. He wouldn't have seen it at a drive-in, but he would have seen it when it turned up at an art house theater, when Warners were trying to give it that prestige push that failed. But I think the joke in the episode of Cheers is that Fraser gets arrested and has to be bailed out from some traffic charge. And Woody asks him, says, Dr. Crane, was it crowded in the jail cell? And Kelsey Grammer just goes, no, Woody, just me and half the cast of The Road Warrior. And then Woody Harrelson goes, did you get Mel Gibson's autograph? So the joke works on multiple levels because, you know.
That's great. Mick, what do you expect next week when we discuss Mad Max Fury Road?
Well, I will actually have de-aged because, as you know, watching that film recharges me on a cellular level and, you know, does things to my mitochondria. So I'll actually have de-aged a little bit. So, you know.
Okay. All right. That's next week. So many things coming up on the site. Boys, I cannot believe we've gone this long on Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, but here we are.
And we did it without doing the MST3K joke. Retain dignity and don't.
Until next week when we discuss Mad Max Fury Road, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, podcast time's here. Thank you, gentlemen.
How does it feel? It hurts. Out here, everything hurts. You want to get through this? Do as I say.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively on Percolated Media.
Welcome to another edition of Thunderdome!
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
Anything I say. What a wonderful philosophy you have. Take him away.
And if you enjoyed this podcast, please take a look at some of our other retrospectives, where we delve film by film into such other franchises as Star Wars, The Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise, Indiana Jones, the films of the DC Universe featuring Batman and Superman, and so many more.
The Toe Cutter! He knows who I am! I am the Night Rider!
If you would be so kind, please take a moment to give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
The men, who are they?
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
How the hell did you get all this together?
Just happened, Max, you know. Beats from here to beats from there.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
this. I know this machine.
He does. He's a rev hat.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett. Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
What do you suppose he's gonna do?
Retaliate first.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
The last we ever saw of him. He lives now only in my memories.
He was on his way. I mean, he had done like Tequila Sunrise and all these other films where he was really trying to get respect as an actor, not trying to do these little action films. Little did he know he would become a huge action star just a few short years later. Matt, did you ever see Tequila Sunrise?
On my honeymoon, yeah.
Mick, have you ever seen Tequila Sunrise?
I've not seen all of it.
And a lot of praise for Return of the Jedi goes to the Jabba's Palace sequence the same way that Bartertown is held up in this movie.
I think unlike the Jabba's Palace sequence, this doesn't make me stop and think, why did three people who knew each other all turn up to rescue Han Solo but with wildly different plans?
Oh yeah, I ranted about that.
Yeah, we did a whole podcast about that, Mick. Don't rile him.
Yeah, well, sorry.
Also,
sorry
for, perfectly uses musical accompaniment for the amusement of the villain.
Yeah.
Now we get some.
Yeah, Miller would produce a couple of other films Duggan made, so I'm assuming he's a fan and that was deliberate, but, you know.
Matt, maybe we should bring Mick on for the Crocodile Dundee retrospective.
Oh, God, right.
No. All right.
Surely they only made one Crocodile Dundee film. It would be foolish to make more than one of those. It's a joke that barely supported a 90-minute feature. So, yeah.
I love how they turned the second one into like this action film. That is one weird series, I got to say. We get a sort of montage of these.
But it's also that piece of self-destruction. Because an airplane is only as good as the pilot that's flying it. I do have to use the bathroom. I'll be back in like 5 minutes.
Okay. You know what? I got to go too. So I'll be right back.
Yep, sure.